Hello, everybody. Welcome to the discussion called Recipes for Revolutions. I'm Sara Blom. This is Niels ten Uyde.
Gürses.
Welcome. As a starting point, I would like to explain how we got together, and then we can take it from there. So I made a film about Occupy Amsterdam. I spent 7 weeks walking around on the square, and I filmed the process, mainly the group dynamics, from the starting point to the eviction. And it was screened last Wednesday on this festival, and I thought it would be a good starting point for a discussion about, for reflection on where the movement is at this stage. How can we look back on it now? And so I had contact with Douwe, and he sort of connected Niels and Seda and I to each other. We all are in some way working on social movement in a broader sense, and also in our personal and work lives. We all have different experiences and different perspectives, but they seem a good overlap in order to facilitate a discussion. We would also like to particularly hear your input. So we all have particular themes that we are interested in. For me, they are the idea of leadership and the consensus model. Particularly, they sort of really popped up on the square for me. I was there as an observer. I made a film, so I didn't participate as an activist, but really as an observer. And I think that's why I'm approaching the matter on a more meta level, which will also be my contribution to this discussion. And Niels and Seda will introduce themselves and the topics that they're working on, and then we can see how we can let the discussion arise. Would you like to?
I'm Seda, and I'm based in Belgium, working at the formerly Catholic University of Leuven on privacy technologies and surveillance.
Yeah. I'm Niels. I'm sitting here with two hats on. One is my personal hat, in which I was very involved with the moderation and facilitation team in Occupy Amsterdam. My more professional hat, and is that I'm a program coordinator for the Internet Protection Lab and Free Press Unlimited. We're supporting digital dissidents, citizen reporters in doing their work more effective and secure in fragile countries. And then mostly focusing now on Morocco, Tunisia, Egypt, and Iraq.
Yeah. I think it's a good idea to start with one topic and take it from there and see how we could. Do you suggest Seda to?
Yeah.
Okay. Cool.
You want me to start? Oh, okay. But all right. So I'm just gonna. No, it's fine. You can stay there. I'm just gonna give a quick overview of some of the issues that were raised in the Occupy Gezi, which has been happening since end of May in Istanbul, but also in many other cities. The basic message I want to give is that. A lot of this has been, at least like the information circulation, has been very effective in pulling people together. But one of the biggest problems has been the censorship of mainstream media. The joke goes that CNN, Turkish CNN, was showing penguins as the protests were evolving. And so many people identify throughout the whole event. This is a protest happening in front of CNN Turkey. And so there were two effects of... Or international and national effects of the lack of mass media, which meant that in the international media arena, we basically saw a kind of soft censorship in the sense that most of the international news agencies were reporting either that was provided by the Turkish government or giving a very reductionist account of what was happening in Turkey, only suggesting that it was happening in Taksim and it was happening in many other places. Additionally, I think there was a clear case of censorship. We have now reports that 22 journalists were fired, 14 forced to leave, and 37 resigned since the Gezi protests started. The numbers are much greater of issues that journalists have in Turkey in general. What this had as an effect is an increase in citizen journalism. And I must here point out that there was a clear case of digital divide. So there was a lot of reporting from Taksim and in Istanbul, and even Istanbul, which were away from Taksim, which were sites of clashes with police, and lots of protests were never reported even within Turkey. So it seems that if you don't have smart appliances, you're not going to be part of the revolution. In Europe, none of the protests were reported, especially those in Kurdistan. So what happened as a result is that the protesters moved to social media and mobile apps, and this had four important consequences. This helped evade censorship, but it also produced new forms of censorship, especially by social networking companies. It allowed for speedy journalism, so you could get timely information during the protests or where clashes were happening or where important movements were happening. There was also a lot of like issue hijacking by the government, so if there was whatever... the case where shop owners started attacking protesters, and the government made an announcement saying the protesters are basically keeping shop owners from earning money, they're in economic damage, and within 24 hours there was a demonstration with the shop owners, and the shop owners saying the government's policies have been damaging us much more. So this is like very speedy response. There was serious issues with information quality. There was a lot of disinformation and the lack of mass media and professional journalism, and also the speed of social networks made disinformation a huge issue, which I will quickly talk about as well. And there was increased surveillance. Very quickly on increased surveillance, the government arrested users saying that it was based on Twitter accounts. It's unclear if the information was received from Twitter, ISPs, or just by general observation. There were a lot of politicians, one of which I'll talk about, which were naming activists on Twitter. So it'd be a governor of Istanbul, of Ankara, would actually name people and say, I know who you are, stop tweeting that way. And there are also promises of a new restrictive law, and there's also use of DPI. That has kind of been used to threaten people from social media use during the protests. I won't go into the details of this. This is one case where a citizen journalism initiative, which started during the hunger strikes of Kurdish prisoners in September last year, turned into one of the bigger citizen journalism initiatives. They're called Ötekilerin Postası. And what happened is they were targeted by one of the government media, like one of the supporters of the government media channels, and shortly after they were attacked on Facebook, and Facebook removed all of their content. They had 138,000 followers at the time. 9 months of worth of reporting with over 50,000 posts were no longer accessible. The Citizen Journalism Initiative did not have a backup, and extraction of the content was not possible. And as the site was taken off of Facebook, a bunch of other people created the sites with the same name, Ötekilerin Postası, and if users subscribed to this group, they were then attacked by the group. So it was like a false creation of a false group in order to identify followers and then harass them. Here's a quick, I won't go into too much detail, but Facebook said that they were removed for pornographic content. When then they appealed, Facebook said, no, it wasn't pornographic content. It was because you have been posting material which has been inciting to violence in the past, and we decided that you've done this so many times, we have removed you. And the example that they had that they could provide me with is here, the Kurdish movement in Syria saying that they may want to declare independence, and this was one of the news that was removed for political incitement of violence. This is from the Fırat News Agency, which is a Kurdish news agency, and they also have had many posts removed about Kurdish movements, LGBT movements, and Femen. But this was not the only kind of censorship that was happening on social media. There were posts that were deleted and disappearing, and there was lack of communication about why these were disappearing. This was especially a problem with shared material. So if you, for example, in Facebook looked at a post and then shared it, then all of those shares would be deleted if that post was removed. And at the same time, it was not clear how Facebook and Twitter were using algorithms. There was a lot of competition about being worldwide trends in Twitter, and it wasn't clear if there were manipulation of these either through crowdsourcing or through the service providers themselves. So what people started to do in response to this, which was really interesting, was to say, please cut and paste my status update, please cut and paste my Twitter, which made sure that if the authentic source was removed, that all the shares wouldn't be removed as well. And this became actually a form of creating anonymity. What it made was it made a lot of people say very controversial political statements, so you couldn't come down to one person and attack them for having made a political statement. It also was a way of going against censorship in social media, because the post was posted so many times that Facebook or Twitter would have to basically remove all copies. While this was very interesting as a method, it also led the way to different forms of disinformation. So as I said, absence of mass media and professional journalism made it very difficult to come to accountable accounts of what was happening. The speed was very important, but sometimes there was an emotional reaction, so you wouldn't actually check the source or check the material that was being circulated, and disinformation would just spread like mad. And what happened also is that law enforcement started hijacking information and giving misinformation themselves. This was especially important because on Facebook and Twitter, people would put up posts about little health centers that were made because a lot of people were hurt, especially by gas canisters and rubber bullets and police violence, and they wanted to go to these health centers, and the police would actually replace this information and lead people to themselves. So there you see that disinformation is a serious issue, surveillance as well, and I will skip this. So what people started doing is basically creating a reflex for giving authenticated information, like how do you reliable information. So there were lots of media initiatives outside of social media or sometimes inside, which were trying to give reliable information. And if I have time later, I would like to talk about where anonymous communications and cryptographic tools may be useful for some of these problems, including surveillance, disinformation, and censorship circumvention, and where there are limitations and what this community can do to help movements around the world. That's it.
Yeah. Wow, that's already like enough stuff to talk about for the coming 2 hours. Shit. And now it's my turn. So... So I think that revolution and radical change happens when the cost of doing nothing is higher than the risk of doing something. And I think this was already said and started in the first talk, and I wanted to reiterate on that. So I want to make clear that the technological tools are not making the change. People are doing that. But people need tools to communicate and do things together. And those are definitely not only technological. So the Occupy movement, at least as we perceived it in the Netherlands, was a reaction to the economical crisis and general political impotency. Like membership of political parties is dropping, election participation is dropping, and trust in national politics is at an overall 50-year low. So the nation states were not able to cope with the problems, and Occupy stood up against that and had a critical stance without formulating very specific demands. And that was extremely important in changing the discourse. So where the news reporters try to find a specific person or a specific demand, say, no, perhaps we don't know where we want to go, but this is fundamentally wrong. And that was interesting, but that was also perhaps a difficult thing. Because we have to be also frank and honest somehow, but yeah, please attack me on this, that after Marx, the left doesn't have a proper theory for the distribution of resources and power. And if we want to change those things, then we definitely should have a theory for that. So that we can also be honest and say we don't have it and work on that. But how are we going to do that? So Occupy hit the right string, but did not completely manage to connect these problems to people's everyday lives. But it was very important to show that Fukuyama was wrong, like liberal democracy was not the end of history. No, there is a post-capitalism because this is definitely not the way we want to live. So then there were the squares, there were this great symbol, but it was also not completely clear what they were. Were these squares a political action, or were these kind of post-capitalist colonies where we would from these centers try to change the world with different practices? Well, if we were going to do the latter, perhaps that was not a really good idea to do that in metropolitan centers, because there are a lot of problems in metropolitan centers that you get confronted with. And people with mentally challenges, prostitution, violence, alcohol abuse. It was hard for a group, for people that did not know each other, so where there was not much mutual trust, to build that up in such an environment in a horizontal way. And then next to that, there's also the problem of social media there. And I think we also see this in Istanbul, we see this in Egypt and Tunisia as well, that social media are great for getting huge numbers of people at certain places. So it's great for mobilization. But when people then are actually there, it might also hamper discussion. Because when you're together in a group, in a physical space, coming to agreement is already hard. But if there are then two or more spaces where people are discussing and don't have a ways to come to agreement, things might get much more messy, and it's much more difficult to see who are the people actually participating and subscribing to the decisions we make, and how are we going to hold and stick to that. So people had very different experience in the past with organizing, so the General Assembly model might not be perfect, but that's what we had and have. And that's hard. So we can say that the union model is broken, but how do we facilitate for this discussion between individuals and groups in protest movements? So this is needed in Egypt, Tunisia, Turkey, Amsterdam, New York City. And we're going out and training people, and this security community and hacker community is, we're training a lot of people on digital security, so like circumvention and encryption, which is super important to share secret information with each other, but we don't have a really good theory for how do we, some stuff we want to have radically open. So having everything, we need strategies for what do we want to have open and what do we want to have closed, and how do we do identity negotiation, and how do we do that on our own terms. And epiphermality also plays a role in that, so that it's possible for you to change your minds about opinions. So there are definitely tools that try to facilitate in this, like liquid democracy or N-1. So liquid democracy is a very interesting tool, but it's also perhaps copying structures from the offline world that... So voting is problematic. Let me leave it at that for that moment. So... before I go into rant on longer, I think these are already enough, quite a lot of issues that we can discuss, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. One thing, I think your remark, what was it about the risk? When the risk is higher than the, could you
when
repeat?
The cost, when the costs of doing nothing are higher than the risk of doing something.
Oh. Yeah, okay. Yeah, I think that's actually a very crucial point in the difference of why Occupy in Amsterdam, well, it's relative to say if it failed or not. I would personally think that it did fail, or at least the image of the movement after the eviction took place in a lot of cities was a lot more bros, what is that in het Engels? Bros?
Fragile
than the first 2 weeks or first couple of weeks that it took place. And if I hear you with all your, you're right in the battle. And I think that's a difference between Amsterdam, that the risk was not high enough to really be organized effectively. And I think that also plays a big role in how it evolved. I think, for example, the mayor, maybe there was not enough action for it to actually be organized well. So despite of all your, the ingredients that you mentioned why it didn't work, I think that's also a very crucial element. The mayor had the he had the space to let it be and to let the group implode because of all these problems, such as drug abuse, people already living on the square before the movement entered. Will you what zeggen?
Yeah. So I definitely do not think that we can say that Occupy Amsterdam or Occupy in general failed. I mean, it would have been ridiculous if we had a turnkey solution for changing everything and replacing power structures. It's a process. Revolutions are not these unique moments where all of a sudden a lightning strikes, right? We need to learn. And so we need new discourse, and it's this is politics, this is identity, so that's always a process. So that's never something that's ever done. So this is a continuous process. And saying also that the risk in the Netherlands was low, I think precarious labor, housing problems, taking away of security standards are definitely, there are definitely risks, and you cannot, I think that increasingly problems around the world are becoming more of the same problems. And I definitely think that problems of not feeling represented, feeling your government not being accountable, is a super high risk. And I definitely feel that there's a very big problems with that.
But I don't think that people experience that enough yet in order to feel the urge to really find a way to communicate despite of all the differences. So I don't think personally there is no risk. I think there's very big risk. But I think collectively, people don't feel it enough yet to risk something in their personal lives. It's still relatively easy enough to see how it goes, to put it very flatly. It's not, I don't think people experience the risk, really, maybe even realize the risk.
Do you?
Yeah, is there somebody who would like to pass around the mic? Well, I'll just do it. Well, I'm going to go to you because I'm already on my way. Is that far
enough? Hi, I'm Sam the Techie from Occupy London. I helped found the tech team there. I risked everything when the Occupy London movement started. When you say we must be the people that you know, because I gave up my engineering job, my house, my rental situation and my possessions and most of my money in support of the movement. And I was there for 9 months to a year. And I haven't gone back to a normal way of life afterwards. I've been part of the hacker subculture in the hackerspace for, you know, 2 years, 3 years, an electronic engineer. And the outcome of the movement was to change me and the way I relate to these issues. And I have loads of feedback on what you were talking about. On a lot of the stuff, because there were technical solutions that kind of came up to a lot of the issues, and I will either feedback to the group or to you personally if that's part of your process of this talk. But no, some people did risk, and just as a cautionary tale to say, like, okay, and you know, those that didn't and then just kind of like relaxed back to the normal way of life, I think were kind of unsatisfied and a bit confused because they kind of felt the spark of something and then it kind of like dying away. And like, so I agree with you, but I also know people that were totally radicalized, and the conditions in London, because of the student movement just before Occupy, and you know, there were people that were kind of already climbing the ladder of engagement and getting involved in things. And it took me, I think, 24 hours, I think, to go from being in my stable, normal situation, working for an energy R&D company, doing like normal engineering work. I literally came from work like the night before, like no sleep, filled my bag with like washing up liquid and stuff, and like went straight down to the camp with you know, donations. And then I was like, and I basically just stayed there under the tarpaulin with a tent thing, you know, did my work the next day and literally left, didn't say anything to them, and just gave up everything. And the next week I was already moved out, all my stuff was donated to the occupation free shop, and I was getting on with stuff. So I didn't look back, and yeah, so thanks.
Well, thanks for sharing that. So I correct myself. I don't think that nobody risked anything. I think what you described, there were also people in Amsterdam that risked like their jobs or study. They were definitely there. But they were relatively a very small group. So it was a very small and concentrated group that took risks. People coming from all over the country and just with a tent and some gear to make it through in the streets. But relatively, that was a small group. And I think in each city, you can't really say that a lot of people took a lot of risk. Very quickly, like I think after 2 weeks, there became a separation between people who really went for it, took a risk like yourself, but a lot of people didn't have or didn't experience the time or the situation to be active full time. So people who visited the square, like in Amsterdam, started to feel left out when they visited the square. And I think that a separation started between people who were more in a radical mode and people who wanted to contribute but couldn't enter anymore. So I think that the outsiders experienced at some point a closed group. So maybe this is a good bridge to the term leadership. There were, and maybe you would be considered somebody who took leadership on the square. You, okay, hold that thought. I don't know numbers, but there were some people that really got into the way. I think Niels, you were one of them, right? You really contributed to the group dynamic with offering ways to communicate. Maybe you don't perceive it like so, but...
Not as in leadership. Define leadership.
Okay. So leadership is somebody who is mobilizing people who might formulate a goal and mobilizes people to reach that goal. If anybody has a better definition, please contribute.
You just defined a coordinator, in my opinion. I think the leader in terms of group dynamics theory is the person who consistently demonstrates to the group that they solve problems when they arise. And then the leader is naturally selected. This is one method that groups create leaders, even if the person doesn't choose for themselves. So sometimes it's really self-actualized kind of creative thinkers that come up with solutions. So like every single little problem, and people's attitudes are like, oh, I'll just ask so-and-so. And it's like literally then the number of referrals that you're getting to like start solving stuff, and you become a key or a point person, even if you don't want to be.
So
this is terrible because you get bottlenecked, and you will literally be running around with a soldering iron and gaffer tape and your bloodshot eyes and coffee and cable ties, and you will be doing 50 things at once. You'll have all the adrenaline you need, but sometimes you just drop. And this is the first 2 weeks of Occupy that I experienced. But I would have never, ever called myself a leader.
So, okay. So, do you think that it would have been ideal if there were leaders? Do you think that would have been...
Sorry.
It would have been more effective if there had been leaders?
The tech team, the pseudo-leadership and duocracy applied to the tech team insofar as the person who had the best vision to solve the problem at the given time could pseudo in order to get it done, but then relax back to being normal. So, and then, so it's about it's the people with the initiative to get the group to focus on the task and complete it in an efficient way. And it wasn't so I don't know if those functions can extend to other types of working groups because I couldn't. So I don't think it scales to the strategy for the whole movement. And so the tech team had a statement of autonomy, which was, with the best intentions of the movement at my heart, I will try and ask for forgiveness rather than permission and just get on with stuff. At the same time, there were self-selecting leaders, people who would put themselves forwards to do a particular task and then try and engage and act as a coordinator to engage others to see the resources that were available turned into the solution that was required for the given problem. I don't know if it works with other working groups, though.
I didn't understand the last
bit. I don't know if it works with other working groups.
So one of the things that I heard a lot on the square was the idea that leadership is something that shouldn't be desired. How do you feel about that? How was that in your experience? Yeah, anybody is welcome to raise your hand if there's people who have similar experiences on Occupy Squares. And I think I'm interested in how people feel about this idea of leadership, and I can't really quite grasp how this man feels about it. So I think let's just narrow it down to the discussion to leadership, consensus model, and not go any further, and then people have more space to, because we can go to someone else, but I still don't really understand your vision on this leadership within the movement, so.
Yeah. Hi, yeah, my name is Miriam. I was actually really interested in hearing examples from current events that are sort of a crystallization of all these dilemmas and theories. I mean, I think, maybe Seda, you could say something about this sort of confusion between, because I sense there's really a huge confusion here between theories of leadership and horizontalism and hierarchy, where it means ideology, and then understandings of leadership, hierarchy, horizontalism as practice. And those are two very different things. Of course you need leadership in the sense of division of labor, hierarchies, coordinated work modes, as long as they're transparent. You need that to survive. You're facing a system.
Of course, it's subjective.
Sure,
right?
I'm not challenging you, but I think that it's important to make this clear, because I think one of the reasons why we tend to misunderstand certain moments in these processes, because they're the processes, I mean, it's not ending. It might pop up again in another form. We see them as failures, not because, I mean, I think it's very important to just remember again what we're facing. We're facing state repression, we're facing a hegemonic, dominant ideology internalized by the majority of the people. You're trying to beat all of that. You will not win that in one occupation or one event. So my question is actually from the Turkish experience, where I thought I've been observing that closely also because I have friends there and you, Seda, where it seemed that in the first week it was sort of celebratory representations of what was going on, and then slowly the dilemmas came to the surface of, okay, do you stay in this square, but how do you risk excluding people who are not the hardcore or the committed activists, but who are the families and the workers and the students and the unions? This dilemma between sort of the soft and radical politics, and how do you coordinate in a way that it is actually, could be interpreted by others as leadership, but actually is a mode of survival? Because I was quite interested by one of the people I heard speaking recently, Ronnie Marquez. I think I sent you his presentation. He said one of the reasons why we had to take a step back was precisely because there was a lack of leadership. There was a lack of an organized idea of what we were supposed to do and how we were supposed to fight the state. We were so caught in our fetishizing this whole idea of horizontalism and non-leadership that we forgot that we were actually facing something that was quite harsh, and we should have actually not been so afraid to admit that we need to have strong decision making processes. Again, processes, practices, not ideologies. That's very different. So maybe you know how it ended up trying to sort of combine the sort of the need and for that, and at the same time this nice ethical dream of being horizontal and not making any imposing any choices. It's such a fresh experience that you can share with us. We could learn for the next Occupy Amsterdam.
Oh, well, I'll do my best, because I've been following everything mainly from Belgium and wherever else I have been. and I'll go there next week and probably can report more. Maybe what's interesting is to look at how the Turkish and Kurdish movements somehow found each other. In the first 2 weeks, it was not clear. Also for like the anti-capitalist Muslims and other small groups, whether this was going to be yet another manifestation of the crusty leftists who have nationalist tendencies and very old paroles. And it was actually, in Turkey, no? Like. I mean, Turkish leftists are a phenomenon of themselves, and I really appreciate their hard work, but it definitely was not catching or sparking the youth as the youth kind of sparked themselves, which was very, very interesting. At the same time, this was the first time many people went down to the streets. They had very little experience, absolutely very bad experience of demonstration and protecting themselves. I think a lot of people got hurt because they didn't have good demonstration skills. But I think that maybe humor was such an important part of this. Like, there's an old kind of leftist parole which says, you know, against fascism we stand shoulder to shoulder. And in the beginning, so what happened is the football fans or shortened ultras came down, and they were really good at making up paroles, coming up with. Good slogans, thank you. They happen to be very sexist as well. So the LGBT movement came in and said, excuse me, can you say that in a less sexist and homophobic and transphobic way? And they changed their practices, which was really helpful. And the leftists were still going with their very strong parole. And a lot of people didn't have good slogans, so they would just repeat the slogans that were being said. And it really helps to have organized people who are good at sloganism for 30 years. So, and then they would say, yeah, like, we're together shoulder to shoulder against fascism. But then there was the question, is Erdogan a fascist, or is it that he's coming up with very authoritarian practices, although he has been democratically elected? And so they came up with the slogan, put your leg on your shoulder against fascism, which rhymes, I mean, has the same sort of word. One is fascizme karşı omuz omuza, and the other one is fascizme karşı ayak omuza, bacak omuza, or something like that. So it sounds very similar, but it just was ridiculizing. And so what would happen is you would kind of open the space by taking the authority of a slogan or a political statement. It happened a lot with what politicians would say as well. So you would take their statement and turn it around. So you would first like undo authority and then start filling it in. So that was the way that the Kurds and Turks kind of found some space, because there was a lot of Turkish flags and nationalist sentiments, and in the neighborhood fora, depending on the neighborhood, you might find some of them more strongly than others. But then what happened is there was a protest in front of a police station in Kurdistan in Lice, and somebody was shot dead, and there were protests all over in Istanbul and Ankara. And I have never seen masses in Turkey go down on the streets for Kurdish people, unless they're Kurdish, and then there are a few of them and they get beaten up. So this was quite a change. I don't want to say now there's absolute Turkish-Kurdish solidarity, but I think there are people who are speaking that weren't speaking before and looking for common agendas.
Were changing, right? This was not the stop of the violence between the Turkish army and the Kurds definitely contributed to that as well, no?
I don't want to go too deep into Turkish-Kurdish politics now, but I think the Turkish government has a similar model as multiculturalism here with respect to Kurds, like let them speak and cook their food, but not give them any rights, you know? No? And I think, say it again? Okay, well, and so I think the Kurdish movement that was kind of finding solidarity with the Gezi movement was a more radical one. So there isn't one Kurdish movement and there isn't one Kurdish voice, and I think there were different voices. Where I think we're going to see some interesting developments is with the elections. So that's going to be kind of tricky because the CHP, which is like the kind of more Kemalist political party. Maybe what's more important, many of the Occupy organizers tried to make sure that the Occupy Gezi was not subsumed or hijacked by any political party. So if any of the political parties came to Occupy and tried to kind of hijack the movement, they were almost booed away. And I think that's a very important lesson to learn. And that's like political parties wanting to take leadership and a refusal of that, I would definitely not say there is no leadership. I think there's a lot of coordination and there's a lot of leadership within small movements, and they're coordinating massively. And I think what they're going to be coordinating on now is with the elections. And that's also, again, like a socio-technical problem. We're going to see gerrymandering, meaning like how do you define spaces in which who can vote for which municipality. We're seeing an information system that is very old-fashioned and very problematic. And also, like, we're seeing the Kemalists now saying, yeah, that AK party, they always fraud in vote as if they've never frauded themselves. So what we're seeing is concrete issues like the election, and different groups are starting to take a position. And I think in Occupy, they learn to build coalitions. I wouldn't say leaderless, but I would say coalitions. So
can you tell a little more on how things are structured? I mean, how do things get done? Because now it's all quite general, but how does it start? Like, who organizes it? How do you organize yourself?
God, there are so many levels of organization now. I mean, there's...
Let me share my experience on how the term leadership in the Occupy developed. There was this idea, and it, whether or not this was a correct definition of leadership, but a lot of people were saying, we don't want leaders, and that's why we're here. We want to organize ourselves, right? It was a deception of politics, political leaders. So that's where it was coming from. But then, under this slogan, no leaders, leaders came up by themselves, and they turned into their own, they created their own little kingdom, right? So verkapt, how do you say verkapt? Verkapt leiderschap? So I think what arose was veiled leadership. So people saying we don't want leaders, and then they created their own little station from where they started to tell people what to do. And that's why I would agree with saying we do need leadership, and we need to be transparent about it. We need to acknowledge that we need leaders, and that's a way to tackle problems that arise when people take leadership. So how do you perceive this in your situation, Seda? What I just described, is that what you're seeing also, or is that not relevant because the battle is so urgent that that issue might not be the most relevant?
Well, I mean, if you declare yourself a leader, they'll make fun of you. It's really hilarious. I mean, like, people have tried to become the voice of the movement and they're shot down like within minutes. It's really hilarious. So, but this is public leaders. So I think there are different kinds of leadership in the Occupy movement. Like, I wish that to no protest, but we have martyrs. I'm very, like, I have my problems with the word. I don't want anybody to die, and I don't want them to die for the sake of the cause or whatever, but it happens, and it's very important to show that there are bodies lost, and these become, like, the face of the protest. So are those leaders, you know? Like, I'm just wondering if they're not different kind of leaders, icons, figures that inspire people. I mean, one of the parliamentarians, Sura Suraya, and that was shot by a rubber bullet or a canister in the very beginning. So that was like something that many people went on the streets for. So you have these symbolic leaders who are also doing hard work, but their presence comes through because their bodies are vulnerable, and you see the vulnerableness of the people and you go out to protect them. If I can, like, the most I can report from is my work with Alternative Bilishim, which it would be nice to come back to. Anybody wants to talk about, like, where anonymity and crypto works and it doesn't work in the case of Occupy, please talk to me afterwards. And where the way we organize there is that it's an association, it's a mailing list. We have a blog. Decisions are made quite fluidly, but I mean, we can all kind of veto. I mean, there's no kind of clear boss sort of thing, but there's somebody who is giving up his life, like somebody who was reporting from the audience, who basically puts his whole life into this. There are two or three people who are obviously online all day, either looking for other campaigns that this group can become a coalition partner to, or creating campaigns that they can become partners to. We're working with different let's say technical communities to create materials for safe usage of the internet or security or whatever. So this is material work. This has leaders. And I think nobody is kind of going into this very superfluous decision, the discussion of we don't need a leader. It's not about leader. It's just hard material labor, and that is taking place. So, yeah.
Well, it does sound like a big difference then. So do you think, where do you think that difference comes from? Is that cultural? Is that a bad question?
No, ask.
Okay. Well,
I have taken the speaking turn. I question the wording. I think we're like blending too many issues together when we talk about leadership. Because earlier I heard you say like, not all leadership is bad, or we need leadership and we need hierarchies. For me, those are two different, completely different statements. I think one of the mistakes that we often make when we create movements or organization. I'm a founding member of a workers co-op, and the same thing happened to me. I didn't want any boss. I didn't want to have any leaders. There is no power. And I think a more productive way, maybe it's a wording, but for me it's important. For me, it's a question of power dynamics and who holds the power and why. So in case of leadership, somebody can have leadership. Like I know that for various reasons in my life, I have acquired various skills that give me the facility to talk in public, for example, or project my voice in a crowd, that give me certain power over people that can be associated with leadership or cannot. Somebody can be very skilled at fixing computers or making network cabling everywhere. He may not necessarily become a leader because he won't have the ability to communicate with people necessarily. So I think that leaders, some have power, some. It's often associated with power, but I think what's really important here is the power dynamics and how the people organize. Like, who's the spokesperson? Who are the figures? Some are dead, unfortunately, and we can't like really criticize them for having too much power here. You know, like, and I think one of the problems we're having in our groups is how those things are pushed away and those issues are not acknowledged because we say we don't have leaders, we don't have power, and it's not true. People don't come from the void, they come from the system, and when they arrive, as you said earlier, they have no, they're not used to making meetings or demonstrations, so they bring what they learn at school, what they learn in their family, what they learn in their workplace, and there what they learn is that somebody tells them what to do, and they either are going to be the person that is told what to do, or they're going to be the person that will tell other what to do, and it's very hard to break out of that. And if we don't acknowledge the power dynamics and the leaders that emerge and say, he's our leader now, or he has some leadership, then we're shooting ourselves in the foot because we won't be able to even identify those problems and deal with them.
Hi. I don't want to divert the debate, but I was wondering... because we still have, I think, something like 40 minutes, and I was just like... No, it said it's 18:30 in the program, but
oh really?
Maybe I'm wrong. Oh, I don't know. And I was wondering if in the way you sketch your debate, there's going to be a little room maybe towards the end, because I think Seda, for example, has some very unique stories to tell, and she mentioned briefly about the use of technology for Occupy and what worked, what didn't work, so on. That's something that I would be very, very interesting to hear about, and if for example, for the Arab Spring as well, that's something, if that could... maybe squeezed in somehow, I would really like to hear those stories. And also your experience about use of cryptography for alternative Bilishim, I would love to hear that.
Yes. Yeah. So I'm just going to give the mic to... Oh.
But Niels, I think you also had a tool idea, which I think would be very interesting to discuss. Do you want to just start with that while the thing turns on? Because I'd be happy to kind of try to read it through the Gezi perspective after.
Oh, yeah, no, great. There are, so, yeah, so let's, so yeah, we all know, so I, I can't resist to say the last thing. We all know that there is this great article in the 70s written about anarchism in the feminist scene by it was called The Tyranny of Structurelessness. And it's like a crucial document is that if we do not do something with structures, then there will be unofficial structures and they will be repressive. So we need to have structures. We just need them to be accountable, rotational. We need to be able to change. We need to be able what's going on. And then we can deal with power relations. So in the meantime, or you can try to brute forces in the meantime. Let's see where it goes. No, so I think this is not only a thing that I think this is a broader problem that we also have with technology. Like a lot of developers have a problem with working with their working with users. And I've been creating some software, and it's so hard to get proper bug reports and feature requests because users also feel very if they don't understand, they think it's their fault. And they're definitely not gonna say that to a developer. Will just say, "Ah, read the fucking manual," you know. Even though you might think that. So, or even if people are really enthusiastic and want to contribute to a tool, then the main features are go on IRC, go on Git, or join the mailing list. And the mailing list might be full with abbreviations or things that they don't know, and can be quite hard. Like, this is really, it doesn't work, your contribution sucks, I won't pull it, that won't be in the main branch, fuck off, right? So these conversations often happen on dev mailing lists, unfortunately. So to make that easier, we're now setting up a crowd contribution platform for tech tools, in which we are, there are only open tech tools, like, or liberation technology tools, because these things drown out on Indiegogo or Kickstarter because they're not a flashy documentary or something from plastic. No, it doesn't really go up. But also a thing is that on Indiegogo or Kickstarter, you can only give money. Well, that's not a really constructive way of engaging with a tool and learning and negotiating your identity with that. So we're going to make it easier for people to do testing, complete integration with TransFX for translation, but we'll also be integrating it with the Open Integrity Index so that it's completely clear on what a tool claims that it can do and what it actually does and whether it's audited and what the policies are, whether open source is really open source. So that's a way that I try to apply this thinking also in technology to make negotiation and use of tools more of a process. Because as a developer, you know that a tool is a process. But as a user, you think it's something that either works or it doesn't. So also breaking this balance and empowering users to get their hands dirty and be part of the production process, that also fits in the information society where we're now not only consumers of news, but also producers of news that can radically change the power relations of to Zeta.
I'm going to, this is a kind of follow-up from my this is a bit of a follow-up from the first part of the presentation where I talked about the fact that people move to social media for different reasons and then the issues they had on social media, and the kind of needs they had, which was like on-demand news about the protest, collection of evidence about police violence, and evading censorship. So if those are the problems, I'd like to quickly, in a very superficial way, kind of go through where some problems could be or where the anonymous communications plus crypto model might or might not help us. So one of the questions one might want to ask is if all these users are on social media, would we like to apply crypto on social media use? And we've been developing a cryptographic tool in our department, which allows you to encrypt your status updates. For example, not sure how that would interact with the newsfeed ranking, and we're not even, I mean, A, there's a problem, it's not clear if that jizzes with Facebook or Twitter's terms of use, so they could actually say you're not allowed to use encryption. There are ways to forego that by putting a kind of a URL to an encrypted material, which is on another server, but that still doesn't solve the problem of, I mean, we do have mediated access to information on social media. The ranking decides what you're going to have access to. You can, of course, manually try to visit profiles and see what people have written or go for the search functionality, but most users will rely on the algorithms that basically mediate what's going to be shown to you. And it's not clear if we insert things like encryption into this model, how it's going to interact with A, the service provider's terms of use, and B, with those ranking algorithms. One of the important things is, one of the things we discussed in Alternative Bildschirm was if we would like to do evidence leaks. A lot of people are worried about repercussions if they would, for example, provide, I mean, I have the shooting of one of the men who passed away, but the student that took, I mean, I shouldn't even say that, the person who took these pictures was very worried about re-identification. So you could say, okay, we want anonymous leaks for evidence collection. But here we go back to the issues that I was talking about. There's disinformation. You lose authentication of the source. You want, so there's always a kind of tension between wanting to know what the who the source is to find out if information is reliable versus, you know, you want them to leak and feel protected. You need to contextualize the information. Where was this image taken? Who was around? Could any of those people maybe function as witnesses or situations? So one of the things that crypto and anonymous communications relies on, or one of its promises, is that you can expect protection independent of the semantics of the information, right? Like, that's what it is. Like, anonymous communications, no matter where you're communicating from or what the content of the communication is, it should work. It's content agnostic. Same with encryption. It should provide you protection regardless of what you're writing about. But in this case, we see that the semantics matter, so we need to find a way of understanding how our tools could be semantic sensitive. I know this is very abstract, but we can talk about this some more later. The other thing about encryption is that, like, within our communities here, we might have a signing party and build a chain of trust, or maybe we don't think that's a good idea, et cetera. but the thing is, for these people who are learning encryption and who have been kind of taught that a tool is something you download and then it works, it's very difficult to start building community practices. I need to find somebody else who installs PGP. I need to have somebody else who talks with me, and we build some sort of trust into each other. So if you don't have a community of practice, a lot of these tools, just single-handedly downloading, is not going to work, right? So we need to think about some of these challenges. About speedy journalism, so there's a kind of inherent conflict there as well. You want to be very fast, and crypto and anonymous communications, especially because a lot of the communication was video, does slow people down. So we have a kind of challenge there, which Tactical Tech has always said, you know, in case of speed, like, you need to change your behavior, and you need to, you know, you need to kind of change your attitude and put security ahead. But we saw in a lot of cases that, you know, the speed and getting the information out and spreading it out so that people can react was much more important. Now, on the good side, everybody is kind of noticing that they can burn their hands or they can be imprisoned. So there's a lot of interest right now in Turkey and related, and probably other countries as well, to learn about encryption and to learn about safe use of technology. It's just extremely challenging because we have Windows users and Mac users, and it seems that a lot of the training material abstracts away just general security issues, and then you're sitting there like, okay, we teach them first about passwords, and then maybe 2 years later they'll be able to use PGP. So these are great challenges, I think.
I have a question.
Yeah, please.
Practical suggestion to help you with crypto training. The crypto party movement aims to be a global, decentralized movement with, you know, no strings, which is trying to invite members of the general public to teach and to learn practically how to use crypto tools in these public meetups. They're free. It's a global movement. Resources have been created. There's the handbook. There are slides.
Yeah.
There are handouts. There are leaflets and flyers. Sure. Happy to pour more.
They had a crypto party 6 months ago in Istanbul. Nobody showed up. I mean, this is like the
can help you with outreach suggestions in that case.
Oh, great, perfect. But like,
so this tell me the problems and I'll overcome them.
I think if we would
you.
Do one now, 20 people would show up or more. But this is the change of context and mentality that wasn't there 6 months ago. And people have been offering training and people are not showing up because the overhead of using these tools, and also, like, as I said, like, how does it deal with social media? We don't deal with social media for good reasons, you know, but I'll come back to alternative social networks and what the issues are there. So if you can just hold in there for a moment. So I guess, like, I don't need to too much repeat this anonymous communications, we really, especially with disinformation, need some sort of source authentication. And we need to think of good practices, digital and non-digital. Like most people will say source authentication, okay, put a hash function, integrity checks. But actually you need a lot more. Because again, the semantics matter. What is in the image? How can you prove that it was taken on a certain day in a certain place? How would you create like information about the community that you can contact if you want to follow up on that piece of information? We didn't think about these things too much in our communities, and I think these are questions that are raised right now. Same goes with metadata cleanup. If you have images and videos, you might want to do a cleanup so that you can't be identified. But again, all of these tensions come up, and we need to deal with them. So one of the proposals, especially when Twitter users started getting arrested, was to say, okay, make anonymous accounts or pseudonymous accounts at least. But this is again a problem in social media where you take a long time to create your friend list or your follower list. So you can't just go and start with a new account and expect it to start functioning. So what you need is that account that has the 500 or 2000 users that are following you. And you need that trust base, because otherwise the things you put up, like, again, how do you know that information is reliable? And if you don't have the trust base, the social media use is unreasonable. So these are really great challenges, I think, that both the typical combination of use anonymous communications and crypto are not solving and are not addressing. And I think everybody knows that if you have a persistent identity, then you're at most pseudonymous, if that. I mean, you're going to be identified eventually. So the protections of that kind of create an pseudonymous account is quite actually risky, which some people are taking. So I have to say a lot of people don't mind. I dropped I have a slide called the fuck it article, the slide, which is like, you know, yes, this mayor of Ankara is following me, but fuck it, you know, like, and I think that's an important part of the protest, and it does really create trust and create like a collective movement, the collective fuck it. All right, so, and the other option is, do you delete your social network profile because you might be, you know, at some point arrested for something you have written? And then you, again, have certain dilemmas, like what do you do with the past? It could be used as evidence. So especially as social media often doesn't let you download your material, this becomes an inherent issue. And it really depends on the company's collaboration with government. We see that Facebook is rather collaborative. Twitter supposedly isn't. And so you can delete your material, but it could be that they still have it and share it with the government, and it's not clear. And it really, again, depends on good collective practices, because if people have shared your material, is it going to be deleted or not? Those are kind of issues that we have to deal with that, again, crypto and anonymous communication does not help in. And what has our community usually done in terms of liberation tech and giving technology to users? We like to drop tools on them, but it turns out we really have to go beyond a momentary training, but think about creating collective practices and look for behavioral change. And I do think you need to develop a security culture. None of these tools are inherently secure. You need to kind of feed back into them and show where they work and they don't, and get that information out and create a trust base. And I think we're most often looking just at the tool and not looking at, okay, have we really produced a good kind of community around the tool to inform people about, hey, we just found a vulnerability, don't use this right now, or give us feedback about vulnerabilities that you see, because I think often we think tool is done and out it goes, and that's not the case. As I said, security is not the only thing at stake here. It's not about confidentiality and anonymity always, and it's really important to be able to create collective action, and then more than anonymity, it's more important to carve out authority, and here humor has played an important role, and therefore disclosing your content is very important. And then you could say, yes, but they can go to alternative social networks. We have N-1, we have RiseUp, we have all sorts of other tools that people can use. Well, it really depends on your threat model. I mean, even with I remember like Tactical Tech was saying like use Google Gmail for a while. They had like this flyer because it has the best security, and then you should have all of your, or whatever, like this was, and you should communicate with others on Gmail because maybe there isn't a secure connection between your mail service provider and another. These are reasonable reasonings, but it really depends on your threat model. We don't know how much Google cooperates with Turkey, but they could also just be cooperating with the US, and the US could be exchanging that data with Turkey. So it's really hard for us to right now see through which services are most reasonable. And then with N-1 and rise ups, like, it's very difficult to find information about how secure they are. And again, we don't know how much access that certain governments have to their information. And most users don't have a trust base. Many people, when I say rise up, they've never heard of it before. So they're not going to trust, they might trust Google more because they've at least heard about it than they have because they haven't heard about rise up. And I'm not saying we should do marketing campaigns, but I'm just saying this is an issue. For example, Tor, like on alternative bidishing mailing list, we have to discuss if it's trustable or not. And I think that's a very healthy question to ask and to ask again and again. But it just shows you even an initiative which has, you know, global reputation, does a lot of marketing and really reaches out to communities, is distrusted because this community is not aware or is not in touch. And we need to bridge, maybe do some bridging work and think about how to close some of these gaps. I would really recommend to this community not to develop a new tool every week, and integrate existing tools and come up with good practices around them. And I will now contradict myself and say we need to maybe develop like usable and portable operating systems and portables that people can plug in. And notice that any tool that you develop, by virtue of the training it takes, is going to enhance the digital divide. Like, the number of people that can use those tools is very little. And the fact that one-time mistake can get you into trouble means that those who are really under threat are going to maybe sway away from them. So we really have to think about, okay, what kind of user discrimination have I created by saying this is the solution that you should use? Who will have more access? Who will have less access as a result of this tool? How can I deal with that problem? I think that's it. Yeah.
How shall we take it from here? How would you like to proceed?
Yeah, let's talk about this. Oh, there's quite some cool stuff in there.
I'll facilitate. So if anybody want, and then I'll give you guys the.
Yeah.
I have one comment and a question. I think it would be nice to maybe talk a little bit about InformaCam. Which I heard Niels talking yesterday. And I have a question which was more related to the first talk. Is there any organization that is systematically archiving instances of social media censorship? Because you explained how, you know, that those instances were copy-pasted and distributed, made public, and then disrupted. And I wondered if there's any people working on that, just systematically building a database.
You want to start with a letter?
Sure. Okay. What I didn't put in the slides is there was a whole boycott against social media censorship. And there some people had collected, like, mostly Kurdish politicians and Kurdish initiatives that have been censored over the last 3 months. And the censorship, the boycott consisted of, it was very cute. You shut your account for 2 days or 1 day, and you wrote, like, I am shutting my account because you're censoring content. I think the question to be asked here is it reasonable? And I think it is, but I mean, this is a debate. Is it reasonable for activists to be using social media and then complain about the fact that they're not getting their rights, especially because these are commercial services that are made for profit? I think this is a debate that we have to have among activists. I think it's great what these guys are doing with respect to, I mean, Articulated Imposta, so they had 138,000 users, and then they were shut down within a few days. They had 80,000 users. They're shut down again now, which I find a form of civil disobedience. And I also wonder if disinformation can be seen as a form of civil disobedience now. Having said that, I'm trying to collect the censorship cases that have been going on. And this is a funny anecdote. So one of the cases was of this parliamentarian, which I mentioned earlier, who was hit by a canister. And his name is Sura Sureya Undar. And one of the posts that went around is that he had something like 238,000 followers, and that his account was censored. It was really interesting. I went through multiple connections to reach him and said, I heard your account was censored. Can I please have the information? And he said, I've never had a Facebso it's not, it's not trivial even to get that information. Like, I've been in touch with Articulate Impostasse, and it's very difficult. Like, the first time they were shut down, the messages they got from Facebook, they lost as well. So there's no evidence there. There is a website for collecting evidence, but this has been mostly like real life evidence of police brutality and stuff like that. I think it's a really good idea to collect these cases, and that's one of the reasons I'm here. So, but there is no systematic collection.
Here's the thing, and it is straight up tactical thing here. You do not control the Facebook is not your asset. That customer, that list of followers is not your asset. So, I mean, it's spelled out on the terms and conditions. So you're sort of crazy from step one if you're counting on that to be your primary means.
Absolutely.
So that's just, I mean, and then you could go run the research. But, I mean, it happens to businesses get shut down for things. It's Absolutely. Not just activists that get shut down things. Somebody violates some policy and poof, they're gone. So just like.
If I can make two quick comments. So this critique was given to them, and they said, you know, we tried to do our own server, and we are not managing. Like, it was very basic. Like, we're just not managing to run a server. We're not going to manage to reach so many people so quickly, and we're effective citizen journalism, and it needs to be fast and, you know, collective and collaborative. So those were the arguments that we got. And I think, I'm not sure if I want to spend my life doing that, but we should maybe resist these companies' bad practices. I mean, maybe that's a worthy cause for some people. And I had something else to say, but I'll just give it.
Yeah, I'm quickly addressing two things that came up in your presentation, and they were about authentication and verification versus anonymity. So in this, technology can definitely have play a role. So we can use the spy and surveillance devices. We use phones also for our purpose, namely to make photo and video and media content more verifiable. So with this app called InformaCam, which is being developed by the great Harlow Holmes of the Guardian Project, you're capturing media, but in the media, it's via an encrypted hash. Timestamp, device identification, tower location, latitude, and all kind of information is coded into the image so that it can use as proof. So, and this, they did it so well that the International Bar Association now accepts it as a standard, and the ICC will probably do this as well. So if you've been following law a bit, then you know that a photo or video material can be highly contended in courts. This will not take it away, but it will give more ways for verification. And they're thinking about integrating InformaGam with a leaking site like GlobalLeaks, so that you can capture the data and then anonymously upload or leak it to Human Rights Watch or an organization of your choice, and then you can provide that information. So that should maybe solve at least a part of the track back and verification. When it comes to the speedy journalism and improving the content there, we've been working on an app called Storymaker. And I'm not going to say that an app is going to solve everything or tools are going to solve everything, because indeed, digital security is only one part. And you all did digital security trainings, and people think they suck, right? They think they're boring, they're not very rewarding. But when you integrate it with physical security and psychosocial security, and you talk about stress and what makes people go, you can develop strategies on how to do that in a more integrated and useful way. But what Storymaker aims to do is help people doing capturing, editing, and anonymous publishing from an anonymous device directly. So you don't need a camera and a laptop, so you can do the actual editing on the phone as well. And there is a journalism and security curriculum built in. So that's the ways we've been trying to address those things, and not necessarily solving them, but trying to improve the tools that mobile and citizen journalists have for themselves.
Is that the one that you were asking about?
Yeah, those were the two.
Yeah.
Can I suggest a speedy journalism hack suggestion for that? Often the message that is effectively broadcast by the act of a protest occurring and it being interpreted through the media and then relayed to the public often isn't the symbolic or the actual message you were trying to deliver by doing the action. So that message is encoded, however, in your banners, the slogans, the chants, and the thoughts and the feelings of the people that were doing that action, and maybe the stated reasons why you're doing the action in a press release or whatever. Proposal, make, aggregate and tag pictures, and maybe use your story workflow for those actual encoded messages and publish them as the digital public front face of a protest, so that it can't be skewed in the media subsequently when the message then becomes... So this is a real-time collaborative process for volunteers to tag and to stream photos about particular message things to the users, to the public as an alternative media source, as opposed to just this kind of pornographically violent images, which is like, oh, and then there was another brick thrown through a window again. So it's like, you know, your whole message is derailed for £50 because the News of the World guy paid the guy and, you know, it was done. So do you see what I'm saying? So it's the kind of the hack for speedy journalism is like, okay, well, the message of the protest was X, as evidenced by this crowdsourced piece of media content, which someone volunteering found for you and knew was associated with your protest, tagged it, and then you aggregate those to a sort of public digital space where you say, this is the message of the protest, and it's kind of a filter collecting net thing. Does that make sense for the speedy publishing, speedy journalism? Just a thought, because then it's kind of like a free... It's a net that you drag along with you digitally to kind of like collect those messages from the public media repos, like the photo uploads and so on.
I should not have started about journalism, because that just opens a whole different approach about representation and things about it. So maybe we can just park that for a moment, because representation is...
Maybe I can just take a little moment to reflect on the story maker. So I think when I said evidence making, of course, we do think of courts. When I think of disinformation, it's a different thing. And when I think of social media, and the speed at which it spreads. So there, most people are not going to be able to do anything with that hash or whatever it is that is being used. So I think there are, again, multiple levels of thinking about who is the evidence or the authentication for. And I think we just need to think through A, threat models, and B, like with respect to information, what are good information practices and how do you signal to somebody this is reliable information? Again, in parentheses, maybe disinformation is a form of civil disobedience. So I'm happy to open that discussion somewhere over beer. So, yeah.
Hi. Regarding this issue of mixing up both anonymity and authenticity together, I was thinking that maybe they are not desirable properties to have together at all. I'm thinking that maybe the bigger the separation between the act of being anonymous and the act of communicating with your source or your journalist or your trust network, is good to have that separation. Especially after being in today's talk about SIM cards, I wouldn't put anything critical on a phone with a SIM card.
And then the vulnerability is like phones are...
So maybe the better thing we can do is educate users to know in which mode they are operating. Now, I'm keeping the separation physical in devices and physical in places and physical in access points and everything. And also related to this, I was pretty interested in learning about what's the experience, what's the user experience about using bootable devices, like LiveTales or live distributions. Are they completely unusable for them?
So I think we're gonna find out. I mean, this is one of the proposals that we're, the project is called Cam Goes to the Fish, which comes from like, it's against jinns, no? Like against bad spirits that you say this. Anyways, it's a Turkish reference. I won't geek out on Turkish superstition. let's go to phones. So one of the biggest issues in Turkey is that we're not sure how much the ISPs are collaborating. So all of these tools, as long as there's some sort of packet sniffing and intrusive, we're not sure how effective they are. And same goes with like phone apps. We don't know exactly how much control these people have over their phones. And so I think routing is a kind of interesting solution there. We're not exactly sure how many people we can get to route their phones. But I'm really interested in, that's why it was one of my proposals to get some little, you know, USB sticks that you can start an operating system from or portables from and see if we can get people to use this. I really think we have to think about the digital divide that we expand by saying this is the only way to be safe. So I think maybe I really agree with your statement that people will have to think about, okay, this is my anonymous mode and this is my public mode. And we really have to think about good tactical media use. Like right now we're organizing a sensitive demonstration that communication needs to be protected. Now I want to reach thousands, so I'm going to go to social media and do really crazy things. But I don't know. I would love to.
Maybe we can come up with an international panel on standards of paranoia modes.
I really think
I've got a videotape of a shooting. I should go into mode 2.
Yeah, there should be a little button that says, like, no. But I mean, yeah, like paranoia is really an interesting thing. But again, like I think we're thinking very quickly in terms of all the problems are about being able to conceal yourself. I think a good number of the problems is about being able to express yourself and to do collective action, and that at the speed that is possible and secure and safe. But, you know, I think that's action more important than security. So.
And it's not about eradicating risk. It's about knowing which risks you take and making that negotiation aware for yourself. So we shouldn't say never use your phone, because then you're also rendering someone dependent on you. But give insight into threat modeling. What are the capabilities of who are your adversaries? Who are your allies? What are their capabilities? What's the likability? What resources do they need? And then you can start coming up with this strategy for yourself, and then you have a kind of sense, and you're enabling people to come up with a sustainable way of relating themselves with technology, etc. And saying, do not use technology like we tend to use with Skype, right? But if Skype is actually for this person a lifeline to unload, to relax, to talk with their mother, nephew abroad or something, then this can also be super crucial for this person. So digital, physical, and psychosocial security, and the paranoia is the same, right? It helps us think, but it also renders us very, it's not good for spirits, and not good spirits, and not good for collaboration, and not good for work. So those are all things that we need to think about. Security is not the only thing, definitely.
One technical intervention you could make would be, I've just seen the hardware prototype, so the Serval project box, which has this TP-Link router, very small, could easily fit in the backpack with the radio module, which is obviously a much lower frequency than 2.4 gigahertz and has very long range. You can have this kind of darknet overlay connecting small groups, affinity groups, or doing actions, and then you can use the Wi-Fi locally on the small TP-Link router to be the only thing that your phone connects to. Your phone is generic, not associated, the IMEI is not associated with your payment details, anonymous, factory wiped. You have never, ever had it at a protest. No IMSI catcher has clocked you already. You have a familiar, nice, user-friendly interface, say Android, rooted, firewalled, whatever you want to do. But you then use all the apps you want. Nice standard platform, nice user-friendly, but you then don't ever connect to the internet ever on this thing. You only connect to your peers, also running off of your small local wireless hotspot as you're running around in your affinity group and your thing, and you coordinate between maybe the affinity groups in a sort of civic swarm over the whole city in this kind of darknet overlay using this lower frequency radio, which has the penetration that can actually cover the city. That could technically ensure that your app can run on the platform you need it to run on in a user-friendly way, but also gets you, because through decentralization, away from the dangers of using the centralized infrastructure, which you're worried about and you don't know about. This could be the certainty of knowledge that it's decentralized and you control all of the key critical bits of infrastructure which allow the communication to occur.
So I think we have we should wrap up. What time is it? So one last remark? No. I think that's okay.
I'm sorry. I'm coming from a very different background. I mean, anthropology, political science, not very. I mean, I'm just interested in internet technology for activism and political change. So I might say things that are very odd, as I said in the beginning. And that comes from the fact that I think one of the problems of technological solutions and the whole history of technological innovation has been, one of the critiques has been this tendency to project a science, a solution that is supposedly universal, apolitical, objective, neutral, can be applied anywhere and everywhere. And one of the critiques over the last few decades have been from feminists, from anti-racists, from all kinds of corners. And I think what could be really helpful here as well, because I'm listening to you guys and I'm thinking, wow, this is really fascinating, practical solutions and advice, etc. And then I'm thinking about my own field works I did in the Middle East, which sounds like, oh, it's all the same, but between the countries, there were so many differences. Like the activists I interviewed in Palestine deal with very different circumstances and require different solution under Israeli occupation compared to Hezbollah activists in Lebanon or even in Egypt. So my critical note would be, what would be very helpful for me would hear this conversation, but with a clear sort of disclaimer or conclusion where you clarify in which conditions this is supposed to be taking place. So are we talking about a revolutionary momentum? Are we talking about a pre-revolutionary, just a mass mobilization for an anti-WTA demo? Are we talking about confronting borders? I mean, these are all very particular contextualized circumstances that I think really define where you put the emphasis on. And there are certain circumstances where actually moving away from technology would be the most radical political thing to do, would actually not encrypt, but be visible, be very vulnerable. So for me, that would be, it might be so self-evident for you, but for me, that is pops up every 5 minutes. What does he mean? What does Niels mean? Does he mean occupy Amsterdam? Or am I now imagining some guy in Ramallah who needs to be anonymous? Or what does Seda mean? Does she mean a Kurdish activist who's already on a list? Or does she mean an upcoming new activist who has not been trained in anonymity? So I would say part of your progressive solution could also be to add, like even if it's a paragraph or two, like something about the context about which you're talking, because I think one of the reasons why people avoid this, why it seems so abstract and difficult, is because it's not contextualized. And I know that a lot of you told me before that that's because we don't want to really get engaged into politics too much. It's so risky. No, not you. I mean, you're the contrary. You have, because it means you have to take side if you're explicit, right? So I think that would really help me, like put like something, like a paragraph. What are you talking about? Is this just fun activism, or is this we want to overthrow the state?
Can I respond to that? Because we have to, I think, do we have to wrap up or not? We do, yeah. So I think it's a really, really good point. And I think perhaps this discussion has been rather messy. I don't know how you experienced it. We did intend to take it from what you just suggested. I think I had the feeling that we have three very different frequencies, and I got a little lost, to be honest, on how to start. And I think it did ultimately sort itself out, and you guys took over, and I do feel that we discussed, you know, that the discussion went somewhere. But I think that your point would be a good starting point for the discussion, and perhaps we didn't choose the right angle.
I had fun, and all the people are still here, so I think it was tolerable. Yeah. And let's see this as a starting point for more discussion over more beer. So thanks a lot, guys. I enjoyed it. Cheers.